Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast. What if your kid grows up in a country that still has one flag, but nobody can agree what the thing even stands for anymore? A place where two Americans can stand in the same room and somehow walk away with two completely different movies playing in their heads. Two nations sharing the same Wi-Fi and side-eyeing each other like they're waiting for the purge siren to start. And what's worse is you can feel it in the way people talk now, like every disagreement is a performance review for your soul, in the way every social media post feels like someone screaming into a pillow, in the way every conversation starts with, "Hey, before you get mad, just hear me out." So let's not start with 1860. Let's start somewhere worse, your kitchen table. It's a school night. Your kid's got a history book open, the Civil War chapter. The one with the old painting of angry dudes in wool coats who look like they all smell like wet socks. You're tired, scrolling with one hand, helping with the other, pretending to remember high school. When your kid drops the nuclear line, "Dad, could this happen again?" You freeze. You want to say, "No, sweetie, that was the past." But your brain is busy replaying the last three family gatherings where everyone fought like it was WrestleMania for the moral high ground. Before you can answer, someone else in the house overhears. They throw in a comment about the other side because, of course they do. Someone fires back and boom, the kitchen turns into C-SPAN with dental records. But it's quieter than that. Quieter and yet meaner. Your kid watches both of you, two adults they love, speaking two completely different languages in the same room. They look back at the picture in the textbook, blue coats, gray coats, smoke in a field, and they ask softly, "So, which side were we?" And just like that, you realize you can't answer the question because everybody in the room thinks you're on the wrong team. And here's the uncomfortable truth. The last time America felt this split, this bitter, this fragile, this allergic to its own reflection, it didn't end in a sternly worded op-ed. It ended in a war. And if what you're feeling right now seems familiar, it's because it should. But before we go any further, let me say this clearly. This isn't a doom and gloom video. We're not here to scare you, sell you fear, or pretend the sky is falling. We're here because history echoes, and if you can hear those echoes, if you can understand what we're living through, you are part of the generation that gets to choose what happens next. So tonight, we're going to trace the fracture from 1860 to right now, and we're going to ask the quiet question nobody wants to hear out loud. Are we watching the next Civil War form in slow motion, or are we already standing in the early chapters? This is Divergent Files. If you zoom out far enough, America in 1860 looked like one country, one flag, one constitution, one big family portrait where half the family was secretly plotting to burn the house down. Because on paper, we were united. But in reality, we were two nations duct taped inside the same border, pretending the tape wasn't falling. Two economies that needed different futures. Two moral universes so far apart, they might as well have been two planets. They didn't clash on policy. They clashed on what the word America meant. Because here we are again, living in a country that still calls itself one nation, while acting like a custody battle no one can afford a lawyer for. Back then, it was industrial North versus plantation South. Today, it's megacities versus everyone else. The supernovas of money and influence on one side, and the millions who feel sidelined, ignored, or straight up disposable on the other. Back then, it was a moral chasm over slavery, not a small thing. Today, it's two reality bubbles that can't even agree on basic math, basic facts, basic definitions of words like freedom, justice, or even country. Back then, America's national identity was hanging on by a thread. Today, that thread is, well, let's just say it's seen better days. In this episode, well, we're not here to fearmonger, pick teams, or start a bar fight. We're here to compare the fracture lines from 1860 to right now and show how civil wars actually start. And spoiler, it's not with muskets. It's with culture, money, identity, and the stories people tell themselves when they're scared. We're going to break down the three realistic models of modern internal conflict, the real shape of collapse in the 21st century. And then we're going to ask the question nobody wants to touch. Is this just another rough chapter in American history? Or are we quietly repeating the same pattern that lit the fuse the first time? Because if a nation dies the same way twice, well, then that's not history. That's a warning. The strange part isn't that America broke in 1861. It's that it stayed together as long as it did. Because by the 1820s, this wasn't one country. It was an awkward roommate situation held together by hope, duct tape, and the world's most passive-aggressive constitution. Healthy? No. Functional? Barely. Up north, you had factories, railroads, cities stacking themselves like Lego bricks. People hustling for wages, reading newspapers, arguing about tariffs, and inventing new machines just to annoy the British. Down south, a completely different universe. Different planet, same flag. Plantations, cash crops, enslaved labor, old families, old money, and a social order so rigid it barely changed from one generation to the next. Two cultures, two economies, two moral codes, two definitions of freedom, and let's be honest, two different Americas, cosplaying as one. Cute idea, zero chance. Even their media ecosystems hated each other. I guess some things never change. Northern papers described the South as a medieval fever dream run by slave barons. Southern editors shot back, calling Northerners cold, grasping factory tyrants and Puritan fanatics trying to run the world. This wasn't North versus South. This was, I don't even recognize you as my species. And the churches? Well, same Bible, but not even close to the same sermons. In Boston, preachers thundered that slavery was a sin staining the nation's soul. In parts of Georgia and Alabama, ministers used the exact same book to claim slavery was divinely approved and abolitionists were the real villains. So imagine two people reading the same instruction manual and still building two completely different moral universes. Well, that was America. And the United part? Yeah, that branding was generous. Talk of secession didn't start with Lincoln. It started decades earlier. And spoiler, breakups rarely start the day you leave. New England flirted with leaving during the War of 1812. South Carolina basically kept a "we quit" letter in a drawer for emergencies. Politicians casually threatened secession like it was a party trick. And real people, families, felt the split long before any cannon fired. Brothers split across states. Parents stayed loyal to their soil. Young men chose their state flag over national identity. Nobody was asking, what does it mean to be an American? They were asking, are you with Virginia or with Massachusetts? Because here's the uncomfortable truth. On the census, they were all Americans, but in their hearts, they were not. Here's the part of American history everyone politely pretends isn't true. We didn't fall apart in 1861. We were never truly put together in the first place. From day one, and I mean Philadelphia, sweaty founding fathers, powdered wigs day one, the United States was less a nation and more a group project nobody wanted to be stuck with. The Constitution wasn't a love letter. It was a hostage negotiation. The South wanted an agrarian empire built on land, hierarchy, and enslaved labor. The North wanted an industrial republic built on trade, cities, and wage work. These weren't differences of opinion. These were competing blueprints for what America was supposed to become. You had two futures, two destinies, but only one continent. And the founders, brilliant as they were, basically said, let's just duct tape both versions together and hope the kids figure it out. But spoiler, they didn't. Foreign visitors saw it instantly. British diplomats noted that the American character changed completely once you crossed the Mason-Dixon line. French writers said the North and South were as distinct as England and Spain. German observers flat out wrote that the US was a federation of incompatible civilizations. These weren't hot takes, they were eyewitness reports. Legally, the split was baked in. Dual sovereignty, state power versus federal power, meant the US had two governments from the start, each convinced the other was temporary. The South believed states were the true nations. The North believed the Union was the true nation. One country on paper, two countries in the minds of everyone running it. And the politics? Well, don't even get me started. Every early political party, the Federalists, Anti-Federalists, the Whigs, the Democrats, was basically a rebranding of the same fight. Which America is the real America? The one run from Washington or the one run from your state capital? Even the presidential elections didn't unite the country. They exposed the fact that a candidate could win half the map and be treated like a foreign invader by the other half. This wasn't dysfunction. This was two nations trapped inside one flag, both convinced the other was the saboteur in the basement. Oh, and here's the knife twist. When people in the 1850s talked about preserving the Union, they weren't talking about preserving a nation. They were talking about preserving an arrangement, a deal, a contract, a compromise so fragile it cracked every time someone coughed. The United States wasn't a unified country sliding into conflict. It was a long-running collision course, finally reaching the point where the brakes gave out. Because you can force two sides to share a constitution. You can force them to share a map. You can even force them to share a name, but you can't force them to share a nation if they were never one to begin with. And that's the truth, history books skip. Because once you admit America wasn't truly one country back then, you can't help wondering what that means for the version we're living in now. Civil wars don't start when people disagree. They start when people stop believing the same country exists. They start like rot in a foundation, quiet, familiar, and dismissed until the house caves in. Forget the movies. Real civil wars don't announce themselves. They unfold in slow motion while everyone insists everything's fine. Here's how the experts actually define the beginning of a civil war. And spoiler, it never starts with muskets. It starts with dual polities, two nations, coexisting under one banner, each convinced they're the legitimate heirs of the country and the other side is an occupying force wearing the wrong jersey. Not, I think you're wrong, but I think you don't belong to the same country as me. Then comes moral absolutism, the point where compromise becomes betrayal. Each side stops thinking the other is misguided and starts thinking they're evil, dangerous, corrupt, un-American, whatever, pick your poison. Debate dies the minute your opponent becomes a demon. Once a country hits that point, institutions start collapsing in people's heads long before they collapse on paper. Courts aren't neutral, elections aren't trusted, and media is propaganda. Pick your flavor. Law isn't law, it's a weapon the other tribe is using. So let's jump back to 1860. The old compromises? Well, they're dead on arrival. The country had negotiated itself into exhaustion. Each side saw every new law as a takeover attempt. States started ignoring each other. Congress became a demolition derby. And parallel legal systems emerged, North and South, interpreting the Constitution like it was written in two different languages. Same document, two translations, zero agreement. By the time Lincoln won the election, half the country didn't see a president. They saw an illegitimate ruler chosen by people who didn't share their world or their future. And once legitimacy dies, well, everything else dies with it. That's the part everyone misunderstands about civil wars. They start in the mind long before they start in the streets. People didn't go to war in 1861 because they wanted blood. They went because they believed the country had already split, and they were simply choosing which half they belonged to. Once two sides stop agreeing on what law means, guns are just paperwork catching up. There was a time when you could ask, "What is an American?" And most people gave the same answer. It wasn't the perfect answer, but at least the same one. And that alone was a kind of magic. It was mid-20th century America, a moment when the country finally felt like a single story being told in millions of homes at the same time. Post-World War II, the country had something it had never really had before: consensus. A shared enemy, a shared victory, a shared future they believed they were building together. Factories were roaring, suburbs were exploding, and every kid learned that the world was divided into good guys, bad guys, and the kid on your street with a weird lunchbox. Simple? Yes. Accurate? Well, not even close. Demographically, the country was 90% white and overwhelmingly Christian. That wasn't an opinion, it was the statistical backbone of the era. One culture dominated the mythology, the holidays, the symbols, the stories. And like all dominant cultures, they didn't call it dominance, they just called it normal. Television helped seal the deal. Three channels, same anchors, same jokes, same commercials, same breaking news. If something happened in America, it happened to everyone at 6 p.m. Eastern, whether you liked it or not. Even the arguments were shared. It was the closest thing the U.S. ever had to a national hive mind. Kids stood up every morning, put their hands on their hearts, and recited the same sentence about one nation. The flag hung over classrooms, stadiums, courtrooms, and nobody in power questioned whether everyone felt included under it. The myth of the melting pot got repeated so often that people forgot melting things usually involved fire. National identity felt thick, heavy, cohesive, unchallenged. Unity is easy when everyone's reading off the same script. But a truth-first investigation doesn't let nostalgia do the driving. That unity didn't mean justice. It didn't mean equality. It didn't even mean inclusion. Millions of Americans, people without power, without rights, and without a voice, were told they were part of the story while being quietly written out of it. Unity in that era wasn't harmony. It was homogeneity. The One America feeling wasn't born out of fairness. It was born out of sameness, a demographic and cultural constellation that made agreement easier because disagreement wasn't allowed to show its face. A quiet country isn't always a united one. The story that united us was never the full story. We like to pretend the country just changed, but it didn't. In the 1960s and 70s, America didn't evolve. It pivoted hard. Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, the single biggest demographic sledgehammer ever swung at the national identity. A generation walked into a country that looked one way and walked out of it blinking like, wait, when did everything flip? The old demographic order was 90% white, mostly Christian, largely culturally uniform, and it collapsed in less time than a lifetime. Like somebody hit change settings on the entire country and forgot to warn anyone first. People love to moralize this era. They turn it into angels versus demons, good versus evil. But we're not doing that. We're here to analyze the part nobody wants to say out loud. The United States went from having a clear majority to having no majority in a single historical blink. Not good, not bad, just massive. Immigration became the accelerant. Not because immigrants were the problem, but because sudden demographic change always rattles nations already on shaky foundations. Every empire in history gets reshaped by the people who join it. Ours was no different. The country wasn't threatened by who was arriving. It was threatened by the fact that nobody in power bothered to prepare the story that could hold everyone together when they did. And yes, some people are going to jump in here and say, well, but we united immigrants through the American dream. That's what held us together. Well, no. That's the postcard version. The real version was different. The American dream didn't unite everybody. It united everyone who felt like it was actually reachable. When a country's economy is booming and the path upward feels open, people blend a lot easier. But when wages stall, housing explodes, costs rise, and whole towns feel like behind, well, even the best national story starts to wobble. Immigration wasn't the problem. The problem was that nobody updated the story so it could hold the old America and the new America at the same time. It was a shift that would rock any country, let alone one already made of duct tape, grudges, and competing mythologies. America's identity got hit with whiplash. The old story stopped fitting. The melting pot, the shared calendar, the predictable culture. And the new story? Yeah, nobody bothered to write it. The institutions scrambled. Schools didn't know what to teach. Politicians didn't know what to promise. And for the first time, America wasn't one narrative. It was an argument about which version deserved the spotlight. You could feel the identity crisis building in real time. People clung to the old narrative like a life raft. Others walked away from it completely. Most were stuck in the middle, confused why the country suddenly felt like a place that needed subtitles. Unity didn't die. It just stopped being automatic. Now, while identity was work, identity had factions. And anyone with an opinion inherited a battlefield. You could see the insecurity everywhere, in politics, in culture, in the way people talked about the country, like it was a relative going through something awkward and possibly permanent. For the first time in its history, America became the kind of empire that didn't know what its people looked like anymore. Every country has a founding myth, the emotional glue that convinces millions of strangers they're part of the same us. It doesn't have to be true, it just has to be shared. America's myth was simple enough to fit on a lunchbox. Land of the free, home of the brave, anyone can rise, and everyone belongs. The fracture didn't start with politics. It started when the country realized it didn't have one shared story of itself. Schools taught different versions of the past. Heroes swapped places with villains, depending on the zip code. One town celebrated a man as a defender of liberty. Another called him the architect of oppression. Same figure, different worlds. You could feel the myth thinning out in the culture. Battles over what kids should say in the morning and whose memories should be honored in the afternoon. A country isn't united when it can't agree on which chapter still counts. The Civil War didn't end in 1865. It moved into the textbooks, and each side wrote a different ending. The South kept its own memory, not a neutral one, not an apologetic one, but a proud, sanitized story built to justify survival after defeat. Some called it heritage, others called it revisionism. The North kept its own version too, the righteous crusade, the moral triumph, the victory of unity over chaos. Two stories, two Americas. Tell a country two incompatible myths long enough, and eventually the myths stop fighting quietly. You can run a government without agreement, but you can't run a nation without a story everyone trusts. For the first time since the country was born, America isn't one myth. Go ahead and call that healthy debate if you want, but we both know what it really is. A nation forgetting who it told itself it was. The Civil War didn't end. It just moved into history books, and each side printed its own. The Civil War wasn't just moral, it was economic, and so is this. For most of American history, the economy was the glue. Messy glue, unfair glue, sometimes toxic glue, but still glue. People lived in different places, believed different things, voted for different parties, but they all rode the same economic wave. Well, that wave now broke. You can feel it in the geography. A handful of megacities became supernovas, exploding with wealth, opportunity, tech, culture, and enough rent prices to make a grown man cry in a Trader Joe's parking lot. Everywhere else, slow decline. Entire towns living one factory closure away from total collapse. Same country, two economic universes. One where people build apps. One where people build debt. This is what historians call a dual economy. The exact condition that turned North and South into the incompatible futures before 1860. And it's happening again, but cleaner and colder. Automation eats jobs. AI eats industries. Housing costs trap people where they stand. Healthcare wipes out savings faster than any battlefield ever could. And here's the quiet part we don't like to say out loud. People aren't radicalized by ideology. They're radicalized by bills that they can't pay. Economic despair becomes political anger. Economic anger becomes cultural warfare. And cultural warfare becomes identity. And identity? Well, identity is where civil wars begin. Divide a country by money long enough, and eventually the map will redraw itself. In 1860, you chose your newspaper. Today, the newspaper chooses you. Not by what you believe, but by how mad it can make you in the shortest amount of time. You see, once upon a time, America had three TV networks. That's it. Three anchors. Three versions of the world. If something happened, you heard about it at dinner. Then, you argued about it in the morning. But now? Well, the country gets carved up by cable, sliced thinner by talk radio, and pureed into emotional smoothies by the internet. Then the algorithms get involved and rearrange your brain like furniture. We don't live in 50 states anymore. We live in digital nations. Your neighbors aren't the people on your street anymore. They're the avatars who share your outrage at 2 a.m. Your community isn't your zip code. It's your feed. Geography didn't disappear. It just stopped mattering. You don't pick your news feed anymore. The news feed picks you. You can thank Operation Mockingbird for the warm-up act. The CIA's little experiment in turning journalists into megaphones. People pretend it was a Cold War thing. Huh, that's cute. If the government ever stops shaping the news, then you should worry. Well, Mockingbird didn't end. It went from whispering in newsrooms to whispering in code. Now, everyone has trusted experts, tailor-made for their ideology. Left, right, up, down, doesn't matter. Same event, two separate headlines, a dozen narratives. And by bedtime, you're certain half the country is completely insane. A bomb drops somewhere overseas? Well, one side sees betrayal. The other sees justice. A third side sees a distraction from a scandal nobody was talking about until the news told them to. Try having one country under those conditions. You can't. A nation can survive bad leaders, but it cannot survive discordant realities where neighbors can't even agree on the shape of the sky. The receipts back this up. Poll after poll shows media trust sinking into the floor, not dipping, not wobbling, I'm talking about falling like a brick thrown off a roof. And here's the uncomfortable detail. There are almost no news outlets that both sides trust. Not one, and not even close. When a country loses shared institutions, it loses its grounding. You can't have a unified nation when everyone is living inside a curated hallucination. America didn't just split its media. Media split America. And once the news stopped reporting truth and started shaping it, well, you didn't just stop agreeing on the news. You stopped agreeing on what's real and what's American. Here's the part where most people either panic or completely tune out. Well, you don't do either. You measure. Because if you're going to talk about the future of a country, you don't close your eyes and hope. You look at the cracks in the foundation and ask the only adult question left to ask. Is this still a house, or are we standing in two halves waiting for gravity to finish the job? So let's start with the obvious. States are suing each other like they're going through a messy divorce and fighting over the dog. California drags Texas into court. Texas fires back. Florida jumps in like it's a custody battle they weren't even invited to. Then you get sanctuary zones, cities declaring themselves immune to federal orders. And right behind them, anti-sanctuary states refusing to obey the cities, refusing to obey the feds. Some states pass laws that openly contradict federal rules. Others build laws designed to spite their neighbors. It's not a rebellion, not yet. It's something quieter and honestly weirder. Authority evaporating. Meanwhile, the economy fractures along political lines. Whole companies get blacklisted because of who they advertise to. Boycott lists grow longer than grocery lists. Millions of people proudly buy from their side only. Patriotism redefined by shipping preferences. You put all that together, and you're looking at the early stages of what political scientists call jurisdiction stress. It's the soft launch of a conflict no one's willing to admit is already in alpha testing. This is the pattern you see abroad before a country tips. First, the courts lose credibility. Then the law lose legitimacy. Then the people lose patience. And because America loves a sequel, our institutions are reenacting the same beats. Researchers tracked in Yugoslavia, Lebanon, Northern Ireland, in a half a dozen modern states right before they fractured into something unrecognizable. You don't need armies for civil war. You just need a growing list of places where the rules don't match the borders anymore. So, how close are we really? Well, we're closer than yesterday, and not because of a single moment, but because of a sentence that slips into more conversations every year. I don't recognize their authority. Once a nation starts thinking like that, civil wars don't start with a bang. They start with a quiet sentence. You are not my authority anymore. If there is another American Civil War, it will not look like the last one. No gentlemen in itchy coats marching toward each other like bad theater. The next one, if it ever comes, will be the kind of conflict you don't even realize has started until the map stops making sense. So, let's walk through the three shapes this thing could actually take. Model 1, state versus federal government and the standoff. This is the one everyone secretly imagines, the showdown at the constitutional level. It starts quiet. A governor refuses a federal order. Not symbolic, but just real. Something that matters. Maybe it's immigration enforcement. Maybe it's gun laws. Maybe it's federal agents stepping into a state that says, yeah, no, turn around and go home. The federal government insists. The governor digs in. And suddenly, the National Guard is standing there wondering whose uniform they're actually wearing. This isn't fantasy anymore. We've already had previews. Alabama in 63 telling the feds they couldn't enforce civil rights laws. The Bundy Ranch standoff, where ranchers and federal agents pointed guns at each other in broad daylight. Border states today building their own barriers and daring Washington to stop them. And turn on the news. See what's going on in Minnesota nowadays. At some point, a flashpoint doesn't cool off. Agencies get blocked from operating. Courthouses get ignored. Federal warrants become suggestions. In the moment a state says, we don't recognize that authority, the civil conflict has already begun. Now, model number 2, state versus state. This one is sneaky, and honestly, more likely. No shouting, no shooting, no uniforms. Just pure psychopathic paperwork. States block highways and ports for safety reasons. Water gets cut off during a drought due to conservation needs. Power grids get rerouted. Goods from certain states get banned outright. Not political, they'll say just policy. Sure. Meanwhile, attorney generals launch lawsuits like artillery shells. One state sues another. Then the countershoots start. Then the sanctions. You don't need soldiers when you control power lines, shipping lanes, and supply chains. If California blocks truck access from a red state, well, that's war. If Texas cuts the power flowing to a neighboring state during a heat wave, well, that's war. If Florida bans companies tied to another state's laws, that's war wearing a suit. In 1860, states fought with muskets. Today, they'd fight with power grids. Then we have model number three, the irregular civil war, essentially 1,000 small fires. This is the model political scientists lose sleep over. Not armies, not states, people. A shooting, a protest, a riot. Something small that gets recorded on a phone, uploaded, edited, and then weaponized. Armed groups show up to protect their community. Another group shows up to stop them. Police try to hold the middle. Then the middle collapses. Some officers quietly pick a side. Others walk off. A handful defect. Foreign intelligence agencies toss gasoline onto every digital spark because chaos is cheap and America is the world's biggest market. So you don't get Gettysburg, you get Milwaukee one night, Phoenix the next, Charlotte the week after. Never big enough to call a war, but never small enough to ignore. This is how modern civil wars operate. Not one giant explosion, but 1,000 small fires burning at once. Now, what can't happen like back in 1860? So, we have to make this clear. There will never again be a neat blue versus red map. There will never be the South marching against the North. That world is long gone. The states are too mixed. The population's too interwoven. The infrastructure too nationalized. The economy too integrated. Your electricity doesn't even come from your ideology. Your bank account doesn't care who you voted for. Your military bases aren't assigned to your preferred political side. And nukes? Yeah, nobody's firing those. So, a clean secession? Not possible. What replaces it is much messier. Because neighbor against neighbor is harder to contain. But infrastructure warfare is harder to rebuild. Digital sabotage is harder to trace. And fractured legitimacy is almost impossible to glue back together. This is why every expert says the same thing. If another civil conflict comes to America, it won't echo the past. It will invent something new. And nobody, absolutely nobody, is ready for that. Now, let's pump the brakes on purpose. Because after an hour of walking through the cracks in the floorboards, this is where most people grab their coat, mutter, it's not that bad, and check out. So here's the uncomfortable grown-up truth. Yes, we've been polarized before. Yes, we've had ugly decades. And yes, this country has a bad habit of setting itself on fire every few generations just to see what burns. But we've also done something else. We've pulled back. More than once. Look at 1968. Cities burning, assassinations, riots, tanks rolling down American streets. People genuinely believed the country was breaking for good. And then it didn't. Somehow, the center held. Not because everyone suddenly liked each other, but because the institutions stayed intact long enough for the fever to drop. The courts still functioned. The military stayed neutral. Local governments didn't collapse. People kept showing up to their jobs, their churches, their kids' little league games. So we still have guardrails today. In fact, plenty of them. Your local grocery store still opens even when Congress shuts itself down like a malfunctioning theme park ride. And the vast majority of Americans, left, right, center, confused, they don't want violence. They don't want collapse. They don't want to reenact 1860 from their driveways while the dog hides under the porch. Most people want the same thing, a life that makes sense, sanity. So let's be clear about what this episode is and what it isn't. This isn't prophecy. This isn't the YouTube version of a bunker salesman whispering, "It's time." This is a map, a way to look at the terrain without pretending it's a cartoon. And that leads to the real question. The one smarter than, are we doomed? And braver than, we'll be fine. The question is this. Can a country reboot without a war? And yes, I know what you're thinking. Is any of that realistic in this climate, with this economy, with these problems, with these politics, with this level of cultural trench warfare? Or is this whole reboot idea just pie in the sky? And you're not wrong to ask. I'm asking it too every day. A reboot doesn't start in Washington. It starts on streets you actually recognize. Small stuff. Neighbors choosing each other over cable news. Local identity outranking party identity. Regular people caring more about what happens in their zip code than what happens in a comment section. And it sounds like nothing. But that's exactly how stability works. It's quiet, boring choices repeated by millions. And yes, it also starts in classrooms. Not with rewriting history, but with teaching kids how not to get played. How to question a headline. How to tell the difference between journalism and political cosplay, routine pretending to be journalism. A country survives when its citizens can tell when someone is trying to hijack their brain. And we need a shared story again. Something honest enough to hold the ugly parts, wide enough to include the people who never felt included, and flexible enough to grow with us instead of trapping us in the past. And in a country this divided as today, this angry, this exhausted, yeah, it does feel impossible some days. But here's the difference between collapse and recovery. A nation isn't saved by the people in charge, never has. It's saved by the people who don't let go. And that's you. That's me. That's anyone still here after everything we just walked through. The risk is very real, but so is the choice. There's a moment in every Civil War book, usually somewhere near the middle, where the letters home start to sound the same. A kind of tired sorrow. A kind of disbelief that people who shared a flag, a church pew, or even a childhood could end up on opposite sides of a battlefield. A kind of quiet wondering, how did it come to this? You look around today, in the news, the headlines, the arguments, the tense family dinners. The way people talk like the other half of the country isn't just wrong, but they're alien. And you feel that same ache in your chest. Not fear, recognition. You watch your own kid grow up in a country that feels different every year. Sometimes inspiring, sometimes unrecognizable. And you wonder what version of America they'll inherit. The one you and I remember? Or the one you hope for? Or maybe the one that's still forming with every argument online and every quiet act of decency nobody films. It's easy to feel small in moments like this. Easy to believe the story is being written by people far above your pay grade. But that's a lie. This country was never shaped by the loudest people. It was shaped by the ones who refused to walk away when the loudest people were wrong. Neighbors who still help each other even when the news insists we shouldn't. People who still believe this place is worth something. Not because it's perfect, but because it's ours. And no, we don't know how this story ends. But here's the truth that's been quietly holding this place together for a very, very long time. If we have enough people willing to stay human in the middle of the noise, enough people willing to choose decency over dopamine, enough people willing to see their country not as a battlefield, but as a home with problems, then we're not totally doomed. Not guaranteed victory, just not doomed. And sometimes on nights like this, well, that's enough to keep going. I'm Ralph, and this is Divergent Files. Listen, I appreciate you. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. the unintended consequences of these programs. They had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.